Escapers. Episode 2 is over, but we are just getting started. My name is Grace, and I'm here with my friend, Sarah. Sarah, how you doing?
No comment.
I know your solicitor said you could say no comment, but I just have a few questions that, you know, if we could just run through those, that would be great.
No comment.
Yeah, see, you know, it's a pretty important pod, and if we just don't get through the questions, how long can we keep this up for, Sarah, do you think?
No comment. Obviously, no comment. I nearly. Hello, Grace. It's so nice to see you. I have plenty of comment. Yes. Despite what I said twice, I have plenty of comment podcasting today from the unceded lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and very happy to be talking about this bedeviling piece of theatre, television.
I am podcasting today from the traditional territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabeg, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples. A really powerful episode of television. There's lots of the stuff, the artistic choices that we may or may not have liked from episode one, but this was certainly, you know, mostly two of our finest actors, particularly for me, Olivia Colman and David Thewlis, getting to put on quite the performance in an episode of TV on HBO.
Yeah. And Kate O'Flynn, our DC Emma Lansing, just, we spotted her in episode one, and by God, she came through in this episode. She's amazing. She's 5'4" of extraordinary, I think.
Yeah, we talked a lot about Olivia Colman, David Thewlis, and like what we knew from them. We talked about that a lot, but really, Kate O'Flynn kind of comes out of nowhere. I have not seen her in anything. I'm just looking at her filmography. I haven't seen her in anything, and I think she's very, very strong in this. Yeah,
excited to get into it.
Yeah. All right. We can jump into it. We open on the girl running again, these seemingly flashbacks, or so we presume. And then we see, you know, inside of an apartment, and we have this green filter on. And, you know, I said we'd get into it, but perhaps, you know, I am mostly intrigued of, do you have a theory for why certain things have a green filter and why certain things might have a red filter, Sarah?
I don't. Yeah, I think my irritation has been noted from last time. Uh-huh. There's later in the episode we're going to see something which in reality is red, depicted as green in one case, and then ordinary its own color red in another case. And that I thought, well, is it green? Is it red? What's green? Is green for go? Is red for stop? I find it irritating. I suppose what I should do is stop down and see if I can make a distinction between the red and the green.
I don't have any idea what the difference is between why something might have a green filter versus why it might have a red filter. And I'm not sure we'll ever know the answer. Some of these artistic choices might be made without our, you know, care for whether we will ever find out or not, I think, maybe.
Well, I think certainly from last episode, the red seemed to be Susan's angry or distressing memories. And then green, we saw the green filter when it was Christopher regarding himself with an ambiguous expression, which, you know, David Thewlis is just the master of, in the mirror and seeing himself as the cowboy hero that she sees him as, and that was green. So I think there we see, oh, well, okay, so red is distressing, green is positive, but that doesn't flow through to this episode, I don't think.
Because the beginning is, there is this green filter as we sort of see a man sitting at a piano, a woman sitting on a couch having a drink. And as it pans around to the other side of the wall, we see Susan with her head against the wall, quite distressed. I guess the way you could look at why is this particular scene green is because it's overlaid with Christopher saying, you know, just tell the truth one step at a time. Like we said, you know, all of these positive affirmations. And again, This episode will play on themes of Christopher being a protector. So it could be when she's viewing Chris as someone that protected her from further evil, and therefore that while the actual things that happened are bad, that she found Chris and Chris was able to protect her is a positive thing. So I don't know. There's some really good imagery here, I thought, with like the tenseness of like the shots in the house, the flashes through the window, two shots each time. We cut to Susan waking up in her jail cell, and Christopher yes. as well. Yeah.
Well, just on that, going back to the shot of the house, quite a natural shot, I think, in the dark, and then the two flashes in the top window. That imagery is so strong and so good. And I think this is where, as I said on the last episode, you know, the shot of the phone booth and the location of this character inside this phone booth in a desolate, light industrial area. So visually, this director is really strong. And I'm just feeling like this other frou-frou isn't needed. I will say I'm wrong if I do change my mind, but so far I've found myself more irritated by the curlicues. And we got yet another form, another layer of this surreality. It wasn't even surreality, it's sort of theatricality. We got another layer of it, a different style again, which we'll pick up as we get there with Victoria Coach Station and London Pub.
Mm-hmm. So Susan wakes up in her jail cell. We see Christopher get some breakfast. Susan's solicitor arrives. I had him written down as a lawyer in my notes, but they only refer to him as a solicitor. Can you care to elaborate the difference? I was saying lawyer, but is he not a lawyer?
Well, solicitors and barristers are lawyers.
Okay.
So they're all lawyers.
Okay.
But in England, in Australia, they have different functions. So, and some a person can be both. My grandfather was a solicitor and a barrister.
Okay.
So a solicitor takes instruction, and I think at some point in this episode you'll hear the phrase "taking instructions."
Mm-hmm.
So they are the one that will interview you, be with you, advise you. Look up all the case law, do all the legwork, and then the barrister is the one who stands up in court with the wig on their head.
Great look.
It's a great look, and grandstands to a greater or lesser extent, presents the case, interrogates the witnesses on the stand, but all the preparation is done by the solicitor.
Okay. Got it. So this is Susan's solicitor. I don't recall in the episode them giving him his name. His name is Douglas Hilton, played by Deepa Ola. But I don't recall him getting a name. He's normally just known as the solicitor in the episode, from what I gathered. I watched it twice. He comforts her, says, yep, the first night is always the hardest. She asks about his advice to not tell the detectives anything. And he tells her, you know, it's just pretty typical to say no comments to everything, at least until they know more. Susan asks if they can speak to Chris, if they can communicate with one another. And he says, no, they typically sort of frown on that. They don't like both people to be able to chat. And he starts taking down Susan's stories. She gives lots of details, the route numbers, everything. It's like, you know, to me, this read as this is a well-practiced story. And she wants to give every detail to, and he's saying, no, I don't need the minor details. And I just need you to slow down. And she envisions Christopher at the bus station giving a thumbs up. And I know that there is sort of a green hue.
It's a complete set. So it's in darkness. There's a slight platform that he is standing on with a neon square around him and a sign in neon saying Victoria Coach Station, and he's standing in it. This is what I referred to as sort of yet another form of theatricality. And I'm a person of the theatre, and I love theatricality. It's just the mixture there. But
you're not loving it. You're not loving the the breaking of the fourth wall, as it were.
I don't mind the breaking of the fourth wall. I think for me it's the inconsistency. So we have the cloudy red and green. We have flashbacks. We have black and white. we have now this very stagey representation of these two very important places, Victoria Coach Station and the London pub, unnamed London pub, which we're going to come to. And the thing is, this section as written is really fantastic. Mm-hmm. Her memory of what Christopher said, the interview with the solicitor, she starts to, as you say, give the details of the coach route 450 as it was then. She starts to say he cuts, as these things go, he cuts her off when he will hear when he is reading out her statement in the interview room at the police station. She adds in the, as it was then, it might not be now as these things go, and this is going to be very important, as you say. I love his line, it's not my job to have opinions.
Yeah, pretty.
she asks him if he doesn't believe her, and he says, it's not my job to have opinions. And I think this is a very nuanced performance by this actor. We feel he might be slightly inexperienced, not terribly inexperienced, but perhaps at the beginning of his career, but he doesn't do any kind of gross indications of that. He's very earnest. He wants to make sure that he gets everything correct, that he looks after his client, even in the refusing to speak to Christopher and why he can't speak to Christopher. But I think he also knows that separating these two accused is going to be better for his client. So we get all of that and this almost low vibration of his nerves or his concern. It's a really nice, nuanced performance in the, you know, up beside these extraordinary actors.
I think that's what I was saying, that I was just little, I didn't say this, but that the fact that we don't know his name, I feel like is a disservice to him. He's not the central bit of the story, it's fine, but I feel like he does a good job here, and I feel like, you know, for us to not really even know his name in this episode is a little bit of a disservice to him. But I thought that this episode, you know, when we talk about, she looks over, she sort of envisions Christopher standing at the bus station giving her a thumbs up. I thought that for the most part, the choices they make in this episode in terms of compared to what they did in episode one, I feel like they're a little bit more consistent. Unfortunately, the ones that they choose to keep are the ones that I was less excited about. I loved her sitting in the bed last episode. I loved, him writing the email. And so we don't get a ton of that stuff this episode. What we get is more of the like, more very clearly that they're in some sort of performance, that they are performing, or, you know, him sort of looking off stage, giving her a thumbs up. But I mean, at least it was sort of one consistent type of style that they chose this time. But
yes, that's true. I think the two examples that you're bringing up, her watching the film, the gunshot as he pushes enter on the email, to me, there's an internal truth to that. So she is washed by the film. She is enveloped by the film. That's how she feels. Mm-hmm. When he sends the email, it's a gunshot. That's what it is for their story. Mm-hmm. Whereas the neon representation of these two places, as yet, I don't feel there's an internal logic to it, that being the expression of it. Whereas them both holding up fish and chips on the bus, I just thought was brilliant because that's how it feels to them. So I suppose for me, I follow, how does it feel to them and to the characters?
I guess it's true. The lifting up the fish and chips is like them sitting in the store. Like that's, you know, that's what it was like. Whereas the other, I feel like there, I guess where I'm thinking we maybe agree in that there are two distinct artistic styles, which is one is one where they make these artistic choices that reflect how the character actually feels in that moment, and they express it in this medium that you can't do in other mediums, in the movie or TV. You're able to do it and it'd be much harder in a different sense. And then there's this other piece which I do feel like this is the piece of the show that, like, to me makes sense why they cover these people. It's these two people who clearly are obsessed with like Hollywood and old Hollywood and movies and memorabilia, who are now thrust onto the stage where they must perform, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that the director is trying to, you know, very clearly play with that, that these are people who are performing. And it is working for me because I have no idea whether these people, if the story that she told is true or not, I have no idea. I can't tell if this is a genuine performance of two people who we should feel sorry for, especially Susan, or is this a case of them loving Hollywood and playing an act. I really can't tell, and I think it's really intriguing. So
yes, and that part of it I do like, and I like being not being told. But again, here's a beautiful, beautiful visual trick, is to sort of cheaper word, a beautiful visual conceit. They both do it at one time or another when they're being interviewed at the table. They look down towards their own hand, and we see the hand of the other.
Yes.
And to me, that's so beautiful. And it's, and they have a little smile as they imagine that other person being next to them. And you think that's how they feel. And I understand so deeply how they feel. And it's so simple, yet it's radical, yet it's so wonderful. As I say, it makes me more than, but I've made myself known there, but that moment, I can even feel it now. I'm getting terribly excited just thinking about that moment. I mean, Susan in the first scene says he's just down the corridor. It's like, she can feel him. He's just down the corridor.
Yeah. Lansing and Wilkie are two younger detectives are starting to interview. They interview Susan. Collier is in charge of interviewing Chris at the beginning of this episode. But I do love, as they have discussed, that she will say no comment. And even at the beginning when Emma's like, and this is your signature? And she's like, no comment. He's like, actually, you can say that that's your signature. You know, it's a very quirky. I mean, a lot of this episode is spent in these two rooms, these two interview rooms, but I thought there's some good stuff here. And we get the actual, you know, telling the story according to Susan, what happened, as he reads off, Hilton reads off the statement that they have prepared, that she is not responsible for the death of her father. She believes that that was her mother. She did shoot and kill her mother, but only after provocation. She says that her husband had nothing to do with the death of her parents, was only made aware a week after. And then there's more questions, but she answers them all pretty much with no comment. I think there's this very good acting moment where she's so pleased with the no comment of it all that she's, and says, why are you laughing? And that's sort of when she she's, you know, stones her face a little bit. And it's, again, says no comment, but, I mean, this is the reveal of what happened. I knew a little bit. I know that their parents die. We know that they're burying the first one. But I thought, you know, the unraveling of the story here, I thought was pretty well done here and in this episode as a whole.
Yes, I agree. The timing now of us finding out, I think we know right from the very first moment of episode one that they have been they're convicted of murder. We know in episode one who the victims are. We hear from them, but we'll tell the truth. We'll stick to the story, but we don't know what the story is. And then this almost fanfareless placement of their story, I think, is wonderful. The fact that it's Douglas, her solicitor, who reads it, and when he hands over the piece of paper, he says, "It's my handwriting, but it's my client's words." It's this almost quietness and plainness of this scene in the reality of the scene where the four of them are around the table that I just love. And it's for, you know, wonderful performance, kind of each contributing so beautifully. And it's shocking, her story. Mm-hmm. I don't know what we thought their story might be or what ideas we might have or what the truth is, but the story plainly laid out in that way in Douglas's voice is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So in a police room, Collier, Lansing and Wilkie come in. Collier has said they found some unusual activity. They found they have the memorabilia spread out across the entire table, and it says apparently they were friends with Gerard Depardieu.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
But before that, we've seen a flashback to a first date or an early date between
That's right. So there is this moment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that where we are now?
Yeah, where Susan returns the breakfast. She doesn't eat much of the breakfast. This scene, it's so small and it gives me but it puts you right in Susan's headspace. And again, I do wonder, you know, I feel like there's the way in which Chris calls Susan fragile, the way that she can come off as a little, even meek in some ways. Like, I wonder how much, again, of this is like, it's either performance or this is almost something that's in her head, the way she's like, you know, and just give my compliments to the chef, or, you know, it's tough to make scrambled eggs on such a large scale. But she gives the coffee back and the breakfast back. Just this very small interaction. She's so sweet. She's so sweet here. It's so adorable. It's so nice.
She's apologetic for not finishing her scrambled eggs.
Yeah. But then we do get my compliments. Yeah,
my compliments to the chef or whoever it is that prepares the microwave packets.
Or whoever it is. It's great. It's so good.
Brilliant.
Susan and Christopher are attending the last metro, seemingly some sort of, they're watching a Broadway play is sort of what I am. I don't know if the last metro, I didn't look into this. Is the last metro?
The last metro is Le Dernier Metro. Which is Gérard Depardieu, of course, Catherine Deneuve, written and directed by François Truffaut, a film from 1980 that we were all absolutely obsessed with.
Okay.
So it's the story of a Jewish theatre owner in Paris, married to an actress. His wife is an actress, and she concocts that they will hide him in plain sight, basically as an actor in the theatre, to conceal him from the Nazis occupying Paris. So handsome, Gérard. We were all mad for him, mad for her. Catherine Deneuve, also one of the most handsome women to ever live. I wonder why it's the last metro. It's not enough if they actually went there and it was the truth. I mean, I was trying to think of the themes of the film as it relates to Susan and Christopher. All I could come up with is her kind of fantasy about living in France and her quite correct obsession with Gérard.
So a quick look into the last. I should have looked it up because I feel like it's important. But it's talking about how the movie is about a theater troupe. They are performing. Mm-hmm. They are performing. They are watching two people perform, in the same way that we are watching potentially two people perform.
There
right?
You go.
It's a play within a play. This is a play within a TV show. Their own imagination. That to me. Mm-hmm. makes some sense why the last
I think would be plus great love. Enduring love against the forces arrayed outside.
So they watch it, they head out, they have a meal, looks like to be in a diner, but Susan very quickly this is a cute interaction of she's speaking in French. It's this thing where like again, what is true and what is not true, because what happens is that we get these like angles of them, and then there is a voiceover. So rather than they're not like, we don't see them talking to each other, we see a voiceover and it's her speaking in French and then him saying in French, I'm sorry, I can't speak French, I'm not going to be able to converse with you that much. And so again, I just wonder, like, is this when this flashback is happening, how much of what we see on the show are we supposed to say that happened, right? Because again, the whole idea of this being a show within a you know, a performance within a, you know, it is a true story. Well, it is a story, you know, the true fades away. This is a story that they're telling. Whoever is telling us this story, I feel like they're grandizing the first date a little bit, as much as it is also at the same time, it's beautiful. I love TV. I know it's not real. So, you know, I think that is really interesting. She realizes she's late and she needs to rush out. She's worried she'll miss her bedtime routine. They have hot chocolate and hang out before bed.
And they call it story time.
Story time. I thought this was, she's like, I'm going to miss the whole thing. He's like, what if you just stay at my house? I'll stay on the floor. You can have the bed. My mom is on the couch. And so, yeah, there'll be no funny business. And they head back.
No funny business. No funny business.
No. So yeah, very sweet first dates. And again, well, if you can imagine subcontext here that she says she's so worried she's going to be late, that she'll have missed it, she'll have ruined it, that she might be reprimanded. And Chris, from the very first time they ever met, he is her protector. He protects her from having to go home and there to be sadness, madness, anger, all of that stuff. So, yeah.
Yes. I liked him here. Yeah, they give him more hair.
Yeah, he gets more hair. It's good.
He gets more hair. He doesn't wear his glasses. She's transferred. I feel in the calf, it's a calf that they go to afterwards, mm-hmm. that she, it's in black and white. She's looking at him with those eyes. And they've just watched Gerard and Catherine and this great love story. She's imagining speaking in French. And this is how she sees him. She, yeah. It is this moment of the big eyes in black and white and looking at him, and she's decided, and he is pleased to have been decided upon. Yes. There's almost we imagine it's the first date, but there's almost like you can see this growing agreement between them. There's no problem between them. She has a slight problem and anxiety. He comes to serve it and to save it and to save her. It's wonderful, and it's so domestic when they go to his house and he goes into a little cupboard and gets her a towel and reassures her that the sheets were changed yesterday, in case she was wondering. And one might almost imagine her enjoyment of day-old sheets that Christopher lay in the night before. Brilliant. In a very romantic and sensual way, I think.
Yeah.
While it being this incredibly cramped, domestic, little, tiny, mean house with a drunken mother asleep on a sofa.
Yeah, you know, that happens.
As the witness to this blossoming love.
Obviously things don't go well for Susan's parents, but we get a glimpse into Christopher and one of his parents in this episode, which is quite interesting. We'll get there in a second. So we cut back to the present day. Chris is being interviewed without a solicitor. He's been told many times that he does not need someone who could just tell him what to say and when to say it, when he knows what to say. And he tells his account of the story that Susan had went to go visit his parents while Chris stayed at home. The following weekend, he had learned of the events that transpired, the death of Susan's parents. And Susan felt that nobody would understand the complexity of the situation. So while Chris might have wanted to call the police, he agreed with Susan that they would not call the police.
And this is also where we get the telling us, he says, National Express through Route 450, it was then, it might have changed now, the way these things go. And when our wonderful Detective Constable Emma Lansing sees this in the recording of the interview, she and we get a real shiver up our spine and we go, oh, that's exactly what she said, using exactly the same words on this really minor moment. So it's a wonderfully placed moment. Again, whether that actually happens or not, I don't care, because it's a wonderful piece of writing and a great character moment for our Emma.
Cut to the interview sort of like fades out, and we watch them in the room watching the interview. Wilkie doing his best, Gerard Depardieu. I give him grief. She tries it twice. I mean, when the first, again, much like his boss, Collier, when the first bit doesn't land, you could just try it again. When the joke doesn't land the first time, you just go for it again. They're talking about they feel like perhaps their best piece of evidence here, because they think that like the story that they've concocted could potentially just mean that Susan probably gets 5, maybe the max is 8 years for a manslaughter charge. Chris would probably get 1 year for some sort of obstruction of justice. That's not probably not what they call it in Britain, but that style
interfering
of
with the interfering with the coroner's proper actions of the coroner. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're pretty. They feel like there's more to it, and their biggest piece of evidence is that the bullets would indicate that the two bullet holes on her parents would indicate that the same person shot them, because it seems like they come from the same spot. Whoever was standing in one spot, it makes sense that they would shoot that person and then they would shoot the second person. So there is some debate in there. Why can't we, let's give them that. Let's throw that evidence, this other guy who's this other detective who shows up, and they sort of stop him. Lansing, this is where Emma right on, Emma. She asks if she can do both interviews. Let me get in their heads. It's good stuff. At this point in the show, you know, we're like midway through this episode, but you know, take this episode as a whole. What do you think? Is the story that Susan and Chris tell, is that the story? Or is there more to the story that, you know, have they done more wrong? And perhaps done a lot of wrong?
There's a couple of ways to think about it. And one of the ways to think about it is liars will tell exactly the same story each time you ask them. Mm-hmm. None of the details will change.
Uh-huh.
People who are telling the truth, the story will veer wildly. There's a fascinating project of what they were doing in some cases. And so one would think, because of this sort of sticking to the story thing, that it is a lie. But say it's true. Say that you are in the home of your parents where you haven't been for a year. You hear a gunshot. You get up. Your mother has shot your father and then turns on you in a drunken rage and says the most appalling thing that she could possibly say, in your view. She's been waving a gun at you. You have got hold of the gun and you shoot her. This could be true. This could be true. And you go home for a week and say nothing. This could also be true. And then the fact that you've rehearsed the story for 15 years is what makes it sound rehearsed, because you've rehearsed it, but it could also be true. So I'm fascinated. I'm interested as well in Emma. She sniffs this story. She goes in, and I think she's made up her mind as to what's happened, and that what they are being told is not true, or that there is more to the story. And we do hear several times in the episode, there's more to the story. Interestingly, the DCI says to her, "You've got bollocks, big bollocks today, don't you, Lansing?" And for the first time calls her by her surname, which is what he calls the male officers. Yes. Previous to this, we've only heard him call her Emma. So I thought that was also a very nice piece of writing that should be noted. What about you? What do you think about these stories?
So I think in this whole thing, there are three potential stories. There is the story that Susan and Chris tell us. And I think the idea that, yep, they've been sitting on for 15 years, that this little hint of doubt that like, they'll never believe us. Let's just bury them in the backyard, go on with our lives. You know, there's a little piece of me that like wants that to be true. I don't think it's true. What I think is more likely to true, and maybe this is the one I want them to be the most likely to be true, is that this is a tough thing, because I feel like the abuse by her parents, I'll never be mad at Olivia Colman, but if she makes me feel bad for the Susan woman and then nothing ever happens, I'll be quite incensed with Susan Edwards at the end of the show. So I think the other two logical stories is, one, everything is a fabrication. Everything about Susan and her parents, and Susan has probably mental health problems that are, being the performer of it all, can concoct a sad story that sounds sad, that she can convince somebody else to buy into, that this is what happened and that her parents are bad people. And then they kill them. And then there's like the alternate to that is like all of that stuff is true, and it's not this crime of the moment. It still is plotted. It still is. They're bad people anyway. You know, we see the financial there's some sketchy financial activity. Let's kill them. Let's take their money. They're bad people anyway, right? So I think there's like three versions. One is Susan and Chris are bad people and none of it's true, and they just kill two people, her own parents. Second one is like there's a hint of truth in what they're saying, but it's not totally true. And then there's like the story that they're telling. I can't see how it's the story that Susan and Chris tell. There's too much in this about them being them loving, you know, Gerard Depardieu, for me to feel like it's case closed. What a tragic story for these two people to fall into this unfortunate. I don't see that. But the middle one, where this stuff did happen to her, and then she decides to kill them, and then they try to cover it up with a story, to me is perhaps the most intriguing avenue. But we'll see.
We will see.
So Lansing is interviewing Susan and bring up the fact that while she has given a statement, the piece that doesn't add up is how did your parents end up in the backyard? Susan is still saying no comment, but she does then learn that Chris has opted not to take legal advice. another great bit of writing where earlier we hear Chris, I don't need people actually annoyingly keep telling me that I can have a solicitor. Could you just tell him that it's free?
Brilliant.
It's very good.
Brilliant.
And Lansing is using this rather effectively. He's chosen to be cooperative, and Susan is rather upset with her solicitor, with Hilton.
Yes. Yes. She says, well, I'm doing one thing and he's doing another thing and we're not together. She's furious because, you know, again, this idea, he's down the hall. They are not together physically. They're not together in their stories. She's concerned.
Yeah. So, so they head back to her cell and she's looking rather concerned, but he does tell her, don't worry. You're very strong. Your performance is very strong. Don't take the bait, stay strong, stay focused. And then we cut to Chris being interviewed again, but this time he's being interviewed by Lansing. This is a good scene, I thought.
Yeah. Well, he asks what happened to the other officers. And another beautiful piece of writing where she says, oh, something more important than you, apparently rather rude if you ask me. So she puts herself on his side so beautifully here in this tiny moment. You just think, oh, we love Detective Constable Emma Lansing. Yes. Okay, so she sort of endears herself, endears is the wrong word. She is saying, oh, I know, look there, I'm on your side.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about liars, if they are lying, liars don't think other people are lying. So I think this is a very nice kind of interaction between Christopher and Emma.
Right. So he gives more of the story, says that when Chris calls her, when she's in Mansfield, I think is where our parents are, she doesn't give any details. But her mother, she had a bad weekend. Her mother was drunk. Her dad was abusive. And he says that's a usual story, I'm sad to say. But they do meet on Tuesday at the Victoria Coach Station and says that Susan was rather quiet. She was acting odd, but she wanted to get a drink, which was unusual because she never drinks. So they head to a pub. And here's where we get another artistic choice. They reenact sort of they're sitting at a pub, sort of reenacting them going to a pub, but it's also him telling the story to the folks. And we get a lot of this throughout the last half of the episode is sort of Chris retelling telling the story while they're where the story is taking place. But this one, I thought that what did you make of the masks, of the drama mats in the background?
I threw my laptop across the room. I didn't quite, but. But oddly, one background actor doesn't have a mask on.
And he stares right at the camera. Yeah.
Everybody else has a featureless mask on of different colors. The barman doesn't when Christopher orders the port and brandy, which you'll all be delighted to know is a shot of brandy and a shot and a half of port.
He gets an Earl Grey.
Keen about that. He gets an Earl Grey too. There is a world where I like the police officers, Paul and Emma, who we're very obviously very engaged with. There's a world where I like them being in the pub. I like them being in the backyard when we go to his story to Mansfield. I like them standing in the bus talking to them. It's just because it's one of five or six very, very different theatrical forms that I think my head spins. I do not understand these plain masks. We haven't seen them before, and it's not everybody in the pub. So I sort of have nothing else to say. But
I don't mind them on the bus leaning over the seat while they sit in the seat. I don't mind them sitting at a pub together. I don't mind them in their house while they're eating fish and chips. I do not understand the masks. And maybe this is something where we have not watched the whole show. So, we'll come back at the, tomorrow and be like, wow, the masks were brilliant because this is why. I'm not sure I see it. I thought that I liked last episode. I liked the people staring at the camera because I thought it was sort of this like, you're buying this, like you're buying all this load, but I don't get it in addition to everybody in the you know bar is wearing a mask and a different colored mask. So I just don't get it. And maybe I'm not as smart as the showrunner, but I don't get it.
Yeah, it's not about not being smart. The director needs to, you know, take our hand, take us yeah. with them, you know. And it's not that things can't be a mystery, but I think last episode I said that I felt really confident in the hands of these performers and this director and this writer. I lost a little confidence with the masks, but let's move on till we find out what they mean in a later episode. Yeah.
But there's a very powerful line here when Chris is sort of explaining the story. Lansing is pushing on his story a little bit. He says, well, you know, all she's ever done is suffer. And I don't think anyone should go to prison for that. Chris says Susan couldn't have done anything to her father specifically. He had too much power over her. They provided the evidence here that they were both shot at a similar angle by the same person. Doesn't seem to faze Chris and Susan. They're going to stick to their story. Specifically here, we're getting mostly Chris. The next Friday, they take the bus back to Mansfield. This is where they pick up fish and chips and they lift it out of their seat to show that they have it. When they sit down to eat, this is where Susan can't take it anymore. She says they haven't gone away. They're upstairs. They're dead. He says, why don't they come down? They're dead. The way he is so casual in the scene is, I haven't even eaten haddock since, only cod. It's like, it's, you know, every time Chris is speaking, there's part of me that believes that unfortunately the story is less true than they're trying to make me believe. And also at the same time, I have this little bit of like, I don't know if you'd call it like watching too much reality TV. I have my editing hat on where I'm like, okay, but is the fact that he's a little bit more obvious as somebody who might be lying, does that mean he's actually not lying? Like, has he actually been roped into it by Susan, who seems more believable because she's a better liar? My head is twisting, Sarah. I can't figure it out.
I like his ordinary man act or reality.
It's been 15 years too, right? So
it's been 15 years. I think there's a very nice practicality about this performance and this man. It may be his character, it may not. Haddock was his favorite. He hasn't touched it since. And when mm-hmm. they ask him about the smell, that seems to be the only time that he's knocked off his little track that he was on of telling the story. Yep. It's an unexpected question.
Yep.
He says the fish. I didn't notice. Did she notice?
I thought that was cigarettes. So, that felt so like, come on, Chris, come on. She's not talking about the smell of the fish. And there's this, again, the way that they're editing this is that they are sitting down at the couch while they're sitting in they're standing in the living room. And the way he says, yeah, I think she mentioned that, and he's pointing to Susan. It's, I don't know. It's very interesting. I think that this to me, I don't mind them being there when he's sort of retelling it as if they're like in the house. I quite like it. And I think it's
And in fact, them being in the house, them being on the coach standing while the Edwards are sitting with their fish and chips makes me retroactively be more positive about the email exchange between the DCI and Christopher, where they're standing in each other's eye line.
Right.
So again, there are elements of this that are so good. I wish I wish to move away the other ones that don't make internal sense, because this makes internal sense. He's telling a story. He's weaving them into the story. Come with me as I take you now to the house of my parents-in-law, and that they're actually there, but they're interrupting and ruining the story with a question such as, what about the smell?
Yeah. Just mostly smelled like cigarettes. Didn't really smell like anything else. That's what he remembers. Anyway, we are going to take a quick break. We're going to throw it to our sponsors, and we will be back in a moment to talk about more landscapers. Okay, we are back. The Chris interview seems to go over particularly well for Lansing and Wilkie. They are very excited. They are pretend shooting each other in the hall. They're bouncing, skipping, walking on air. This is where Collier, he finds Sandra, a detective who has found evidence that Susan opened a joint bank account the day after her mother, Patricia, died. they have Lansing, they have Sandra show Susan the account information. It looks like she withdrew half the funds from her mother's account into the joint account that day. There's a thing she says, I don't remember everything. And Sandra, new character, shows up. She says, oh, you don't have to remember. It's right there. It's very informative.
I love Sandra.
Yeah, she's great. The very small performance, but very good. Very fun.
And I love that the bank documents are labeled Police Exhibit C17/Sandra.
I didn't catch that. That's great. Oh, Sandra, really MVP here. Coley is so excited for Sandra to have found this. Chris chats about the bank account of it all. Lansing calls Susan mercenary, and Chris then repeats that phrase. It was a very personal matter. It's very interesting when you're being investigated for the murder of your stepparents to call it a very personal matter. Imagine that works. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, sure. Okay.
We'll let you go. Yes, what we want. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Emma says,
sorry. Be more personal. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Oh, there's no sorries in Emma's vocabulary, I don't think. This is a wonderful moment. Emma Lansing, Detective Constable Lansing, calls the action mercenary. Christopher repeats the word mercenary, so she does have him on tape saying that word. And then he recants and says that it is, he wants it on record that this is a very unfair thing to call her.
It does her a great disservice to call her a mercenary. He says, Susan has always had much bigger things to worry about than money. And this is where he looks down and he is imagining himself holding Susan's hand in the old movie style that we've seen, that sort of filter a few times. I thought a really good scene. And then also it's just like, gosh, the way Lansing is able to like use this information. It's really well told. I think this part. I think you talked about there being a slip up when he gets asked about the smell. I feel like this is very uncharacteristic of Chris the Protector to have said something that he regrets about Susan. The way that he goes, and this is again an indication for me where there might be more to the scene where he wants to call Tabitha and she says no. No, the way she's so firm in that scene in episode one, and then this where he says she's a mercenary, he says, actually, I'd like to take that back. It doesn't fit with the story. It doesn't fit with the story that they're telling, that Susan has an edge to her, that Susan he actually I think is saying that he's very economical. Oh, she just went to the bank that because it was the day after a bank holiday. She's very economical.
She says she's very economical with the truth. I don't know if this is an expression that North Americans know, but it's an English expression. Being economical with the truth means that you didn't lie.
Yes.
You just didn't tell everything.
Right.
I love it that it's also like economical as in, you know, she can make a dollar a stretch. Yes.
It's just, I think that, you know, we're halfway through now. Right. So the cracks in the story, I don't think will take long to suffer. If there are cracks in the story, and to me, this feels like, you know, a moment where they got him a little bit, where he says something that doesn't fit with the narrative that they've decided upon. And to me, I think that potentially one that Susan has decided upon, that there's this idea that Chris is her protector. I think that that's a role that she has assigned as the director of this play to Chris. Mm.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So we flash back again to their the first date, but this is the night before and they share a little first kiss, which is nice. In the morning, they're eating breakfast prepared by Chris's mom. He whispers, she's not very good at eggs.
Yes. Susan, as Susan politely pushes the eggs around her plate, trying to make them look like this. I think she doesn't like scrambled eggs.
That's true. Well, she says she's not a breakfast person.
She's not a breakfast person.
Yep. She sort of realizes the time that, you know, she needs to head out, and Chris offers to walk her home. Yeah, and this is what I was saying. We get a glimpse into Chris's mom, right? Chris says, chivalry lives. You're walking her home. And we find out that she's the one who suggested that he try the dating agency, which she might try herself. Glimpse into Chris's mom here. We know what happens to Susan's parents, so...
Yes, yep. And his mother, as she bustles cheerfully around making breakfast, but continually dropping things and knocking things over.
Drops a lot of things. She's not doing well at the moment.
She's not well. He describes her as not being well. We do know that his father remarried because we know he has a stepmother called Tabitha.
Yes.
So this might be the beginning of that separation.
Yeah. He drops her off close to home. She stops him. Says, "I think this is, this is good." Again, I don't want these people to be bad people because this scene is so cute when he is joking that you saw my mom, you're embarrassed of me. And this, like, they do this little thing where, like, they keep waving, like he keeps and he keeps like kneeling down and waving. It's very odd, but it's so endearing. The two of them in this moment as he drops her off, not at her house, quite close to her house.
Which, did you notice, is a different house from we saw in episode one? And I don't know why.
Yeah. Because, gosh, if her parents are, like, drunk and, whatever, it just feels like it should probably be the same house, right? They should probably have lived there forever and ever. But
to me, do you know what I was thinking? I was partly thinking whatever, and then I thought, is this significant? Because, this director, Will Sharp, whatever my opinion about his choices, is very particular in all his visual choices. I thought, well, maybe it is the fact of the matter that they used to live there, and then they lived in the murder house.
It's a true fact. Yeah.
But when you're when you're telling me the story, don't distract me with that. Just make it the same house. But anyway. And then on the second view, I was trying to think, was it renovated? Did they take that? And then I realized that
they would have
had
to build a house on the other side that looked exactly like their house.
Exactly. So I don't know why that decision was made. I'm going to put it down to that it was a fact. It's sort of unimportant, but because the director Will Sharp has trained me to look at every part of his frame, to imbibe and drink and imbue the visuals that he's giving me, then I feel a little bit like, well, why are you giving me a different house? But
yeah,
as you say, let's move on.
Well, she can't enter that house anyway. She's locked out. And inside there is a lot of yelling happening. She is asking to be let in, but she does not get let in. And I couldn't tell. I watched this twice. I couldn't tell if Chris hears the yelling or he just instinctively. Again, I wonder whether that's like he just knew to come back. He just knew, and he turns and they stare at each other. And when you look back at Susan, she is once again in the old Hollywood style, staring at her protector. Yeah.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
See, I liked that again, because this is how they feel. She feels as she turns her liquid eyes up the road towards him, and she draws him back, or he's impelled to come back. And yes, I love that it's not clear whether he actually hears the shouting, because it is quite muffled. We only hear it when she gets to the door, but that he feels her distress, or he feels her longing, and so he turns.
Yeah. So Susan leaves herself for another interview, and we get this really long scene that is, it's quite good. I really liked it anyway. They're asking Susan, tell us exactly what happened the nights that your mom, your parents died. She starts by saying no comment, but as Lansing is pushing, she brings up that, Chris called you mercenary. It is frustrating her to the point, and she's quite emotional. And then the other thing that comes up is it's revealed that, Chris did tell us that your mom told you something that night for the first time. She says that must have been really hard for Chris to tell you. She is rather emotional, but she does start to tell the story of what happened. And again, as the show is one to do, we get sort of the police along with her as the story happens.
Yes. And as I said, I do like this technique of locating the police, the watchers, the audience in the same room as the events. And Olivia Colman, who's so amazing, she's standing in the middle of this incredible emotional scene, mm-hmm. as she is interacting with her mother, and then turning back to the police and in quite an ordinary voice saying, well, it was something like that. Look, it's a long
I've been
ago.
Trying to forget it for 15 exactly. years, but you know, this is basically what she's, it's so good. It's
incredible.
Blown away by this whole scene. And it's largely, I think, on the shoulders of Olivia Colman. The mother is, the mom is good. Patricia is fine. Lansing is fine, you know, but this is Olivia Colman's, performance to be outdone by, and nobody can.
Yes.
Yeah.
So she brings them into this bedroom and we see the father lying dead and his blood is green.
Yeah. What the heck? Why is it green?
What the heck? Why? Why are we doing bringing people into the set of the story so beautifully? Then his blood is green. And when she eventually, when we get to it, shoots her mother's blood is ordinary red.
Yeah.
So not even like a bright red or a violent red or a you know, the signifier of, anyway.
Yeah, there's
take some, the crunchy with the smooth, I suppose.
Yeah, there's some stuff. I mean, she's I you know, you're talking about like the rehearsed nature of a liar. A liar doesn't change a story. There is, you know, and the rehearsed lines of like, you know, the, you know, as it was then or whatever. He says, I woke up to the sound of a bang. Say how many? He says, oh, I don't know, two, maybe one, not three. It's just like the way to say, I don't know, I'm not a writer, but like the way to write that of like, you know, it's not one or two, but not three. It's two, maybe one, not three. I don't know. There's just
wonderful.
Like, I like it. She says she doesn't know why, but she knew immediately that her father was dead. Her mother was very drunker than she was when Susan had gone to bed. And her mom is basically saying, like, I had to do it. I couldn't take it anymore. She's waving the gun, pointing it at Susan. She calls her husband a grubby little man and asks Susan, why would you even care that he's dead? And Patricia throws the gun on the bed and Susan grabs it. And this is what I thought was it. Lansing says, why would you grab the gun? She says, well, she was pointing it at me. So I wanted to grab it to make sure that nothing happened. Interesting note there, I thought, of like, part
good
of me
story.
Was like, part of me, yeah, it's a story, and but part of me also
a
feels
good
like,
story. Oh,
we really got to have Lansing say something. In this scene. Like, why did you pick up the gun? He's like, oh, because this reason.
Yeah.
I do think the step from Patricia is like, if not the performance, the writing is really strong here because it really hurts. And as I've said, I am worried that we are going to get the reveal that Susan has made everything up. And so this, the words that her mother is saying to her, it's so sad. And I don't want it to be true. Because I don't want someone's mother to have told them all these things. And yet, if she made this all up, that's awful. She's saying, when I look at you, I know I failed you. Patricia says, I know what he did to you, Susan, but I let it happen. I'm not a monster. We had some good times, even though you were a difficult child. Susan says they should call Chris. Patricia says, Chris is no different. And she tells Susan, you're impossible to love. That is so sad.
It's extraordinary. It's worse somehow than the revelation that Patricia knew about the abuse from Susan's father. And with the extraordinary statement, well, of course I knew.
Of course.
I'm a mother.
I'm your mother.
I'm a mother. Yeah.
Ugh. God,
which
it's
awful.
It's awful. It's
but
brutal.
Then you're impossible to love is such a statement. I mean, the character of Susan as portrayed by Olivia Colman.
Yes.
Is damaged. I won't say deeply damaged, but certainly damaged her retreat into the films, her requiring to have a savior, the codependence that she has with Christopher, the fantasy of this beautiful life in France with welling eyes and handsome husband. It is a drift from reality to some extent. A lot of us spend part of our time adrift from reality, but there is presumably a cause. So while I don't want her to have suffered, as Christopher doesn't want her to have suffered, at the hands of her father and by the neglect of her mother, it's so it's such a straight line between that abuse and the kind of slight detachment from reality that while I don't want it to have happened to her, I hope that it is that and that she didn't make it up.
This is some complex feelings I'm having to like work through and think through. I did not expect this. I knew that this show, presumably these were people who had murdered just from the show. They probably are hiding dead, but like I wasn't sure if this was like serial killer Nate. If like, I will say offhandedly, there was a serial killer in Toronto a few years ago who was doing that exact thing. So it's like, it was very front of mind for me that like that. And so I kind of thought that that's where they were. This is so much more complex than like I thought that was going to be. And then it's Olivia Colman. So I'm just like, yeah, I feel really bad for her. And I don't know what I want the true story to be. I don't know if I want her to have suffered abuse or that is it better that she didn't and then she just killed her own parents. There's no good outcome, Sarah, in two more episodes. There's no good outcome.
There isn't. I mean, I must say I lean towards her having killed both of them with or without Christopher's assistance. A moment, a snap. I mean, we see this in domestic violence situations that the victim, you know, rises up at a moment. And this is why self-defense is very hard in these cases to argue, because at that moment that you killed them, you were not presently in danger.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the best ending is that two people who were abusive to her and like she gets wrongly convicted. We know that they go to jail. I guess that is the best. That is slightly the best outcome. Anyway, gosh, it's all complicated.
It's very complicated, and that's what makes this so fascinating. And yeah. That's what this is where the creative choices that the director makes are fascinating to discuss as well.
Yeah. Back in the interview, Lansing does ask her to confirm that she was sexually abused by her father as a child. And she does say yes. Again, this is very, it's incredible acting and it's very sad. She says she never told her mother because she was afraid of what her father would do if he found out that she had said something. She confirms that Chris was not involved in the killings. And this is where it comes up. Wilkie confirms to them that they will be applying for extra custody time in light of all of this new information.
Yes. The interaction here between these two actors with Emma saying, you know, can I confirm, which is putting her back there, can I confirm that you were abused? And Olivia's mouth becomes extremely small. She says yes. And then she presses her sexually. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just so powerful.
And it really is. It's really powerful. Lansing asks about Chris again, and she's pushing here to say, you know, didn't he just do it? Didn't he just help you? Didn't he cover it up? They were both shot at the same spot, and there's an account. That seems like a plan. And I think what she says... didn't Chris protect you? And Susan looks down. She sees Chris holding, they're holding hands in that old Hollywood style. And she says, of course he did. He always protects me. She confirms that he buries the bodies. She says that it was his idea to bury them in the backyard. And then she says, he's the only person who has ever made me feel safe. And we cut to Chris and Susan are sitting on a bench, presumably immediately after she's been locked out of the house. She says, I've never told anybody this before. He says, it's okay. It'll be safe with me. And presumably she tells them about the abuse she suffered by both of her parents. And this beautiful snowy park.
Snow. Which we saw begin to fall in the interview room. So, yes. And again, I absolutely buy that and love that, because that's Susan's mind. She goes back to that time of the first time he protected her.
Gosh, that's the episode. That's hard. That's tough. Tough watch. Watch it twice.
It is tough because to me, Susan's telling. I was trying to decide who to say, Olivia or Susan.
Yeah.
But to me, Olivia's performance of Susan telling is incredibly real in the middle of this sort of very theatrical sets and people being in the room that weren't actually in the room, in that there's no deep sobbing, there's no hysteria from her, there's just this telling of these events. And to me, that adds to my belief that she was abused by her father, because that is how survivors do talk about it. That's a huge generalization. I would like to take that back, but there is a process that you go through, whether you get help, therapy or not. I'm one when Amanda mentioned Susan, not. But that disassociation, or the dissociation that I was talking about before, is allowing her to tell this extraordinary moment in her life where she killed her mother by whatever provocation. She admits she killed her mother, mm-hmm. and the preceding 40 years of abuse from her father.
Yeah.
To me, it rings completely true and deeply wrenchingly sad, and speaks of much suffering, that she says it quite plainly. I mean, she emphasizes some words, she gets a little agitated, but there's no what we expect from television shows where people, you know, break down and there's much weeping. Yes, that is one way of reacting, and I wouldn't like to take that away from any survivor, but this almost plain dissociated telling speaks volumes to me anyway.
I mean, Susan is somebody who basically up until this particular scene, anytime where there's a crack in her relationship with Chris, right, where he didn't get a solicitor and then he said he called her a mercenary, everything else is not always confidence, but you know, there's an air about her, right, that is happier than this one scene does. And I think you're right, the choice to play it as this, it's sadness that has for a very long time been inside of her that does not burst out. It slowly overtakes her in this moment, I think is really good. The other thing I'll say, we were talking, you know, I'm talking about, do I think the abuse happened? This is, you know, a TV show where there is a, you know, it's a particular story and they are, you know, playing on things that, you know, the idea of her being enamored with Hollywood is a reason for me in this moment to think, okay, there, you know, there could be holes in her story. I do want to just like clarify, you know, my stance is like, believe women, you know,
we believe women.
It's my stance. When people come forward, they don't often come forward because, I'm going to retract this. I'm going to say this differently. Women don't come forward, you know, and lie about abuse. Like it just doesn't happen, and there's no reason to do it. So, you know, it's just in this particular story, you know, the framing of it all leads me to believe that there is a path here where this story is one in which she was not, and it's a story she's telling us, and she's told Chris, and she's telling the police. But you know, that is not the general stance I will take outside of this podcast in real life.
Well said. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Woo! They're halfway done.
I'm more excited now to see the next episode than I was to see this episode, and I was very excited to see this episode. So
it should be interesting. I you know, they. We know that they go to jail. We know that the custody time gets extended. I do wonder, you know, half this episode basically took place in two interview rooms. I am intrigued to see how they maneuver through that. You imagine one of these is a trial. One of these episodes is a trial. Feels maybe a little too soon for next episode to be a trial, but I don't know. We'll see. Okay. Sarah, where can people find you? What are you up to?
Well, they can find me on Twitter @SarahCarradine if you care to follow me there. And what about you, Grace?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Hi From Grace. You would have heard all my plugs yesterday, so I won't belabor them today. But if you're interested, I'm on Twitter at Hi From Grace. Lots of really fun stuff. If you are checking out this podcast, just do the post-show recaps feed. You might want to consider, if you love HBO shows, there's postshowrecaps.com/HBO. Or /HBO pod. You can get everything we're covering over on HBO. Insecure, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Succession, Euphoria, all very fun stuff. And if you enjoyed this podcast and you want some more bonus content, more bonus podcasts, consider becoming a Patreon, patreon.com/postshowrecaps. You get lots of bonus content. You get access to the Discord no matter what level. We're at a very, very fun and welcoming community over there. There's lots going on. Join us there. And at higher levels, I think you can get some merch and some stickers. So all worth checking out. Again, patreon.com/postshowrecaps. I think that's it for now. We'll see you tomorrow.
Toodaloo.